Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great pleasure on behalf of the Board of Wales and London to welcome you all here today. I should like to emphasize that my thanks to both Madhav Bhatka and the Institute of Welsh Affairs for what I hope will be an ongoing relationship over the coming years on matters associated with economic policy and matters that we consider of great importance for Wales. I should also like to thank Bristow's law firm. This is the third year in which they have very generously sponsored this Wales in London event, and I hope that it will continue. So without further ado, I'd like to hand over to Oriol, and who will do all the introductions. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much indeed, Hugh.
I always forget my glasses.
Great. Thanks very much for coming, everybody. I'm absolutely delighted that the first of our collaborations with Wales and London sold out, and people were clamouring at the door for tickets earlier on today. This is the second in our series of, second in this current series of debates with Cardiff University, so very delighted to be continuing that, and the fifth that we've done together with Cardiff. Very pleased indeed to welcome such an illustrious and august group of speakers this evening, and I just want to take a little bit of time to talk a bit about the IWA and what we do and how we do it before we launch into the conversation this evening. Part of the IWA does two things. We've been going for 30 years. We've celebrated our 30th anniversary this year, and we do two things. One is we act as a platform for debate, like this evening, and we do that partly through debates like this, but also through the longest-standing current affairs magazine in Wales, which is the Welsh Agenda. And if you're a member of the IWA, you get this, and if you're not, then I suggest you join. I'm very happy to talk to you about this. It comes out twice a year and has some really good think pieces. All of our back issues are available online, bar the current one and the one just gone. So we like to keep it close for our family of members. We also have a stalwart Twitter following of about 14,000 people, so there's a really good conversation online with a very wide reach. So that's the general side of what we do. On the policy side, we have five groups looking at the economy, obviously, education, governance of Wales. We are putting an official response to the EU withdrawal bill, for instance, recently. Also health and social care and the media in Wales, where we occupy a very crucial role in terms of pointing out the deficiencies in terms of the media in Wales. So we have a media summit coming up in March next year, the third in our series. I tweeted this morning that today's debate is very nifty timing, what with it being budget day. So obviously with the OBR downgrading growth for the next 5 years, it felt a little bit like a blink and you'll miss it budget for Wales today. No mention of tidal lagoon, but you have the experts here to guide us through what the future looks like. So I'm really delighted to hand over to Rachel Lomax, former Deputy Governor of the Bank of England, who is kindly chairing this evening's debate. Rachel, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Can everybody hear? That's great. Okay. Well, thank you very much for inviting me to chair this debate. It's kind of a depressingly familiar subject. I only wanted the word still in it. Why is Wales economic development still struggling to keep up with its neighbours? But as they say, there are no new questions, only new answers. And I'm hoping that we will come up with a few new answers today. As you say, it's peculiarly appropriate that it's on budget day. I don't know whether that was accident or design, but it kind of reminds us that, you know, Wales is nested in a broader UK economy, which is struggling a bit now and maybe struggling a bit more in the future, and no doubt that will come into our discussions. The other thing to remember is we sit here in one of the richest areas of Europe. We're talking about one of the poorest. We live in a country, the UK, which is massively unequal in the regional level, and I don't know why that is, or maybe we will throw light on why that is as we have our conversation. Anyhow, this is a great opportunity to open up these questions. We've got a great panel. I will briefly introduce them because the speaker bios are on the flyer. What we're going to do is give everybody's going to take about 7 or 10 minutes just to make a few introductory remarks, and then we'll try and stick to time so that we can have a bit more of an interactive discussion. And the many opinionated people I can see sitting in the audience will get having a chance to stick their oar in. So we'll start off with Jerry Holton, who's Hodge Professor of Regional Economy at Cardiff Metropolitan University. And then I think we'll pass to Margaret Llewellyn, who is a non-executive director at my favourite airport, Cardiff Airport, and many other things in Wales, and knows about development. And Urfiel Quillen, challenge for me, I'm afraid. Who's an IWA trustee. And finally, the non-Welsh influence on our panel tonight, Lynn Miles, who knows what works as far as regions are concerned. So I think that would be a really good platform for the rest of our discussion. So without any further ado, I'll ask Jerry to set the scene for us.
Thank you very much, Jerry. I think this question is slightly misspecified. Wales isn't struggling to keep up, but it's certainly struggling to catch up. At the time of devolution, Wales was already, I think at that point, the second poorest region of the UK, with GDP per head about 71.2% of the UK average. Here we are in 2017, and it's still 71-72% of the UK average. So in terms of the growth rate of Wales has been roughly the same, actually to within a decimal point or so, as the growth rate of the UK as a whole. We're not struggling to keep up, but we've made absolutely no impression on that level gap that makes us nearly 30% poorer than the average. And if the expectation or the hope was that devolved government, somebody now minding the store, as it were, and paying attention to these things, would somehow enable us to catch up, that simply hasn't happened. So catch up, not keep up, I think, is the problem. And as has been said, we've got this is the case in a situation where inequality, regional inequality in the UK, has greatly increased over those. Over these 15 years or so, 17 years, whatever, since devolved government came in, we've had a huge dispersion in the growth rates of different parts of the UK. And Wales, as you would expect, given that it's sitting on the average, is roughly in the middle in terms of the growth rate of different regions. London has soared ahead. Scotland has done very well, so their devolved government, whether it's cause and effect, who knows, but their devolved government has seen an improvement in their relative performance. And the northeast has done relatively well, which is bad for Wales in a sense, because we used to be the second poorest, and now we're the poorest because the northeast was the poorest, and it's grown faster than average and has now left us at the bottom of the pile. But in terms of growth over these 15 years, we're worse than Scotland, we're worse than the northeast, we're worse than the northwest, we're worse than London, but we're actually better than everybody else. I mean, the slowest growing region's been the West Midlands. That's the story. We're growing in line with a mediocre average. We're not keeping up, it's true, with the more successful regions, and we're certainly not making any impression on the average level of GDP per head. Now, why is that? Some of you will no doubt have heard a speech that has been given quite a lot by Jonathan Price, the chief economist in the Welsh government. And he always says, look, there's no mystery in the history, right? I mean, Wales has always been relatively poor. When we were agricultural, we didn't have any arable land, just pastoral stuff. Industrialization, that was good, but it was all extractive stuff, and the capital all came from abroad. You know, Guest and Crawshay are not Welsh names. So, and once the coal, slate, and iron ore runs out, we're back in the soup again. So where's the mystery? You know, we've always been poor. And moreover, if you look around the world, the two things you find are that high levels of productivity are associated with very high levels of education. And Welsh education has gone down the tubes. You know, if you look at our performance in all the educational measures, it's among the worst in the UK. So, hey, what? Our productivity is among the worst in the UK. You know, it's practically an iron law. Moreover, the other thing that tends to raise productivity is if you've got a big, thriving city, you know, like London or... And we haven't. I mean, Cardiff, 300,000, it's only half as big as Belfast. I mean, so we don't have agglomeration. We don't have a well-trained, you know, population. What the hell do you expect? Whenever he gives that talk, of course, the audience start to froth. Oh, my God, you know, this bloody complacency. You know, where's the ambition? And, yeah, I can sort of understand that. Where is the ambition? But, yeah, I think the point he's making is there's nothing... we're not being cheated here. There's nothing mysterious about our situation. If we want to get out of it, we've got to do something about it. And the point I'd make is you can do something about it. Think of a place where there's no large city and the topography is even worse than Wales. Well, what about Switzerland? Now, they're not doing too badly. So you know, there's no iron law of determinism here that says we have to be hopeless. We are hopeless, but we can do better. How? Well... I think there's one very clear answer, but it's very long run. You know, it's not going to help anybody in this room very much. But we do have to improve our educational system and our training system. That is obligatory. I would hazard that there is no area of the world that's a lot better off than Wales where you couldn't also point to the fact that the level of qualifications and skills of the population is not also higher. We did an exercise recently. We looked at 400 regions around the world, and we correlated different things with the level of GDP per head, and the spending on education was always the most important, the single most important variable. I recently did an exercise of talking to about 45 growth companies in Wales, and I said to them, what's stopping you being, you know, twice, three times, five times bigger than you are? You've got a great product. What's slowing you down? 65% said skills. Can't get the people. And, you know, that's one of the problems in Wales. You get promising companies, but we can't scale them up. If they get to a certain size and they just get bought out, or the guy just, you know, checks out and retires, and we don't have the skills to let these companies grow and reach and realize their full potential in Wales. So that's the first point. Do you know what I'd do? I'd say all teachers are on national pay scales, but we're going to pay them a 10% Welsh premium. If you're a teacher in Wales, we'll pay you 10% more than the national scale. Mm-hmm. That would cost you 70 million a year. There's only 26,000 teachers in Wales, couple of grand each, you know, bang. I mean, I'd do it. I think we have to do something radical to really kickstart an improvement in education, and it would have to run from the bottom to the top. Our higher education system is grossly underfunded compared to the higher education in other parts of the UK. So that's the first thing. Can we do anything in the short run? I think the government could be a little bit more ambitious in terms of its borrowing. It hasn't borrowed very much in order to build certain kinds of infrastructure. But they've got good projects. Take the Cardiff Metro, which is partly designed to increase agglomeration in the Cardiff area, to turn South East Wales into a single effective economic entity, conurbation, if you like. You know, I will lay anybody in this room 10 to 1 that in 10 years' time, they'll still be talking about the metro.
It's expensive.
And the reason is, you know, if you think of a project, it's a 1.5 billion project or something, what should be the overhead on that? What should you cost to set up the administration or the planning of a thing like that? 5%? That's 75 million. Can you imagine the Welsh government going out and saying, we're going to create a statutory authority, we're going to bring in the guy who built the Hong Kong Metro or something, and we're going to spend 75 million to make sure we've got the capacity to make this happen? Please. What they'll do, they'll second 10 civil servants, they'll hire 2 consultants, and they'll talk forever. And you know, we're not used to being ready to set up the delivery mechanisms that you need to deliver complex projects, which is why, if you think about it, you know, we've put a 5p on plastic bags. We've made it the case that you have to opt out, not opt in, of organ donation. All things that don't require any administrative competence. But can you think of a single complex project that's been delivered? You'll be struggling. We've got to. First of all, the government has to do things, but it has to be ready to give up some control and to delegate to effective executive agencies. I'm running out of time, so education in the long run and fixed delivery in the short.
Thanks very much, and thanks very much for sticking to time.
I'm going to stand up because I'm a bit on an end here.
You can walk around if
I've already got some answers for him, because if anybody knows my background, I am Welsh. I was born in Cardiff, but I became an Essex girl at 11. And then I came back to run a shipping line and build a container terminal. So, and I've run trains and I've done many other things. I was vice chair of the WDA in its transition period to the Welsh Government. And if anybody knows anything about shipping, they will know that you know everything about everybody's business that moves freight. So you really understand what this is. So my approach is totally different to an academic approach, because having been the head of tourism for the last 2 years in Visit Wales, and I sit on the Visit Britain board, being on the Development Bank for Wales for 5 years, and obviously since we purchased Cardiff Airport, being on that board, I'll tell you what I've seen that's good in Wales and what's bad. And everybody knows what I think about it, and I'd be open to you challenging me. So when I joined the tourism board, it was about the same week as the 250 wealthiest people in the UK came out in the Sunday Times rich list. Believe it or not, five people on that rich list had received grants from Visit Wales to build attractions or hotels in Wales. Do I think that the grant system is right in Wales? No. Totally and utterly no. Yes, sometimes it should be used to start a development. I think, for instance, St. Bride's, when they came to us in the WDA 17 years ago in Saunders Foot, they had a vision for the regeneration of Saunders Foot, and they needed £2 million to kickstart it. That £2 million, they obviously developed the hotel. They have never been back, and they've reinvested every year since they built that hotel. That works. But where we give grant upon grant for one initiative or one idea after another, but we really don't get anything of top quality because we don't understand what that is, it doesn't work. I feel that whatever we've got, they should be loans. Even if people default after 1 or 2 years, at least A, the person's learnt the discipline of paying the loan back, and secondly, that loan will be used, the money that's come back in can be used for somebody else to start their business. And I'll give you two examples of why that works. We started a micro loan, micro fund for small business in Wales, between £1,000 and £50,000. In the first year, we gave money to 165 people that applied. They can apply online, it takes up to 6 weeks. Not one company in the first year defaulted. So that shows that we do have a bit of entrepreneurial flair in Wales. One of our other early ones was a property loan, because it was noticed that in Wales, the small builder struggled to get funding from banks. The big builder always got funding. And yet these were people that were probably up in the valleys or West Wales, where they had a nice plot of land. They couldn't get planning, they got the planning permission, but they had to lay off their people. So we were given by the Welsh Government £10 million to start a property fund. That property fund has run over 5 years now, and we have not had one default. So that shows that you can make changes. Secondly, when I joined the board, I discovered that we have no international brand hotels outside of Cardiff, other than the miserable Marriott in Swansea, and that wonderful Holiday Inn on the A55 that's not even called that it's in Wales, it's called Chester West. Now, how the hell are we going to get people to invest in Wales if we don't have products that attract them when they want to invest? Thirdly, I discovered that some 70% of my budget for marketing Visit Wales is actually spent in England and in Wales. it's not spent on international marketing. Now, there is a justification for that, because you get the people from England coming to Wales. But it does, will that give us a step change? Of course not. And I'll just explain to you about how poor we are. I was quite proud last week because I went to do the deals for the cruise lines that come into Wales. When we started 7 years ago, we had 6 cruise lines. This year we had 89. By 2020, we'll have every major cruise line with long-term contracts in Wales, because we're doubling the size of the Port of Holyhead, and Royal Caribbean are developing it with us, along with Stena, who owns the port. But as I landed from Seattle to Los Angeles, I was in an Airbus, and I looked out over the international arrivals, and the first thing I saw was a British Airways 747. Obviously, probably none of you in this room know, but both the business seats and the first class seats are fitted out in Cardiff. Every single seat that you sit in on a 747 and every Boeing plane you fly on, it's British Airways, all business and first class seats, but most people don't know. And then along the row, and I was also proud, I thought this is fantastic. There were A380s from Lufthansa, Air France, Etihad and Emirates. And I thought, I thought, I bet not one person in this airport knows that every single wing on those planes come from Wales. And they don't, because when we said to Qatar, great, you're coming to Cardiff, would you please bring your new A350 instead of the Dreamliner? They said, but why? And we said, because we're bringing the wings home to Wales. Qatar did not know that the wings are made in Wales. That is our biggest exporter in terms of money earned in the whole of the UK, and yet very few people know that it's in Wales. We can do a lot of different things. Picking up on skills, obviously, we can't force investment. Many of the places that we have in Wales are either agriculture, but let's be honest, farmers are very entrepreneurial. This year, exports of food from the farming community grew by 20%. So, you know, let's encourage them. The Development Bank are now working with them to try and get them into doing more and more exports. And we've also looked at getting people involved in low-level jobs. Hospitality, you know, let's train these kids. I know that Cardiff Met actually is very good in the hospitality school, but let's take them. We've got 58 now working on Seabourn, the 5-star cruise ship in the world. They are our ambassadors. They are working for us out there telling people. So finally, can I just say to you, I want you to all be our ambassadors, because that's the only way that we're going to change, is to educate people that We've got one of the best workforces. I always say to people, how many workforces, when Tata had all their problems, would the management have walked with the Labour? I've worked all over Europe, employed people, and I'll tell you, Welsh workforces are the best, so we should capitalise on that. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Right, thank you. Well, I've got the unenviable task now of following two excellent speakers, and I guess the danger, particularly with Jerry, of course, is that we do get to some events like this again, that I mustn't duplicate what's already been said. But I think it's important to take a little step back first of all, look at a little bit more the sweep of history and where we are today, and how do we come here, very briefly. And if you think about it, until about 250 years ago, I'm going back that far, Wales was basically, you know, a rural, non-urban society. That's what we were. There were a few major towns or cities, and this is due to a combination of factors, including geography and history as well, which I won't go after. But it was the discovery of coal and iron and their exploitation that has really shaped Wales very fundamentally. I was looking at some numbers a few years back, and you know, 100 years ago, employment in the South Wales coal field was 300,000 people. 300,000. Now, let's assume in those days, it's probably a rough assumption, each of the men working then, it would be a man or a boy, had a wife and two children. That's 1.2 million people very directly involved with the coal industry. And that's out of a population in those days of about 2.4 million. So roughly one half of the people of Wales had that very direct connection with that extractive industry, which Jerry touched on as well. Now, I think that remarkable picture has left us a certain legacy. First of all, a very high proportion of our population lives in towns and villages, which are located there for one reason only, because coal was there. And of course, when the coal went, the coal mines were shut down, the community stayed there. But they're only located there for that reason. Very often when I go up some of these valleys, they remind me a bit of Radnorshire. If you look slightly above the house line, as it were, you see the attractive hills, woods and so on. But why are people there in the numbers they are? Because of the coal industry, which is no longer exists, of course. Another point which I know Jerry's touched on in the past is remarkably few sort of added value activities took place around that extractive industry. You know, a lot of things, like an awful lot of the engineering and so on went on elsewhere. There are exceptions, but by and large that's true. And maybe this affects us a little bit as well. The experience working in a dirty and dangerous industry, I think in some areas, has shaped attitudes to industry and business which still resonate today with quite a few people. We need to recognise that. But really, the history of the Welsh economy at one level the last 100 years is really trying to counter the decline in employment in that key industry. And also, let's put in steel with it as well. And an awful lot of emphasis of public policy has been on creating jobs, the numbers of jobs, irrespective of the quality of jobs. That was understandable, by the way. If you're getting high unemployment, huge losses of jobs, the first thing is to try and get more jobs. And that's what a lot of economic policy, public policy, has been directed at. I mean, and I understand why. When I got involved in looking at the economy, first of all, in the late 1960s, the unemployment rate in Wales is roughly twice as high as the UK as a whole. It's very different now, but it's twice as high. And therefore, quite understandably, government said our first priority is to get jobs, any jobs. And there's a legacy of that, I think. Now then, what are we going to do about this? How can we now change the quality of the jobs? Unemployment in Wales now is 4.0% compared to the UK average of 4.3%. It's true our employment rate is a little bit lower, which disguises some hidden unemployment as well. And but you do the sums on that. I mean, if we have the same number of people looking for work or in work as the rest of the UK, our unemployment rate would probably be 6 or 7%. And I see you're nodding here, Margaret. You've done the sums as well.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, it's down now. The people who are either in work or looking for work, it's down to 4%, which I won't quote the Chancellor saying there's no unemployment, but it's pretty low, right? So what do we need to do? And again, I don't want to go at length through this because this is a well-exhausted list, but so let's get the discussion going underway. But education levels, let's talk about that. I was talking again to Jonathan Price the other day at an event, and when we talk about education, I think there's a couple of issues there. One, we tend far too often to speak, particularly this sort of event, by the way, about graduates and students. And I've often said to my political colleagues, what about the 55% of school leavers who don't go to university? Don't seem to spend much time talking about them. They've been neglected. But Jonathan even corrected me on that quite rightly. He said there's a long tail of poorly educated people in Wales. And when he's talking about poorly educated, by the way, he's talking also about people who are functionally illiterate or innumerate. We're not talking about people who haven't got 3A levels. We're talking about people who can't do the basics. And we have neglected that. So it's very interesting what you said, Jerry. Now, what are we going to do about that, first of all? And there is also, if we're honest about it, you've got some of the valley communities in particular, a lack of aspiration on behalf of the, not only the pupils, by the way, but the parents by now, and quite often, dare I say, the teachers. So how do we get that aspiration going again to get ahead and forge ahead? Skill levels, we've touched on that. And I give a starting example. I spent a lot of my time in fintech. There's a big shortage of people with ICT skills in Wales. This is known. We know about it, yet we somehow can't supply enough people with ICT skills. So there are jobs there begging to employ people, as it were, and you can't get the people. Why aren't our institutions turning out more people with those skills, particularly the skills specifically required by the employers? Not necessarily the academic skills, but those which employers require. We know also that things like AI, artificial intelligence, augmented reality are coming, they're coming down the track. Are we doing anything there to prepare the next generation for those sorts of jobs? I hope we are. I'm skeptical. our management education is pretty poor, and I know again that Jerry and Brian Morgan and others are looking at this and working on it, but we know the UK as a whole, by the way, has a low level of management education skills. We're the worst in the G7. So it's not surprising that, therefore, our GVA per head, our productivity across the UK, is so poor compared with places like France and Germany. So we need to do something like that. The cliche, of course, is touched on again today in the budget. I had the pleasure of being in the House of Commons for the budget, is invest more in infrastructure. But that is important because, again, about a year back, I wrote a piece for Open Democracy on this. If you look at investment in infrastructure in the UK, it's been overwhelmingly over the last 50 years in the South East and in London. You know, Victoria Line, Jubilee Line, M25 motorway, Crossrail, they're now talking about Crossrail 2, HS1. When HS2 comes, it'll be going north-south, but starting out of London, by the way. Huge sums of public money being pumped into the London area to the detriment in terms of competitive advantage of the rest of the UK. Let's be very blunt about this. And even now, we've had the galling experience recently of Chris Grayling announcing he wasn't going to electrify the line from Cardiff to Swansea, only 3 days later to say they were minded to support Crossrail 2. And when we talk about skills, by the way, and big projects, I believe I'm right to say the project director of Crossrail is a Welshman.
Chairman,
thank you. I stand corrected by Maddox. Thanks, Maddox. And certainly one of the leading people behind the Large Hadron Collider in CERN, again, came from Aberdeen Grammar School. You know, so we have those people, those skills. What we don't is deploy them in Wales. But don't anybody think we haven't got the abilities there. But we seem somehow not to get them moving. I'm talking about infrastructure, and Jerry's touched this point. If we got the Cardiff Metro going, that does help address this agglomeration effect and also to a degree the sparsity effect, bring people together. So much easier moving around London, even Cardiff. I spent most of my career in central London, living and working here. It's easy to get around in public transport. South Wales is and Wales as a whole is a nightmare compared to that. One thing the Welsh Government did do, by the way, they reopened the Ebbw-Vale to Cardiff railway line. And some people in Ebbw-Vale, when I was there on a commission, were complaining about the Welsh Government. I said, well, didn't they open that railway line? They said, yes, the trouble is it's crowded all the time. The trains are overcrowded because it's working now to bring people from Ebbw-Vale into work in Cardiff because I'm afraid none of the jobs won't go to Ebbw-Vale. They've got to be realistic. So that's why I personally and politically been pressing that the UK government should, on infrastructure, spend at least another 1% of GDP, that's 20 billion across the UK, a billion for Wales, roughly, for 5 years to get the infrastructure going. We desperately need that. That's very, very important for us. I could go on. Another thing about VCs and loans and grants, if you speak to David Stevens, who's a managing director of the IWA, one of the two founders of Admiral, which employs over 5,000 people in Cardiff, Swansea and Newport, why do they come to Wales? Because the Cardiff Council, I believe, at the time were nimble, got in there quickly, offered them £1 million grant and a good deal, a good office deal, short lease. And now they've got 5,000 people. They didn't know they were going to be successful at the time.
But they never came back. That's the difference.
So you're nearly out of time.
Well, almost out of time. I'd say one thing we need there is to be much more proactive, taking advantage of being 2 hours from London to get into the VC community in London, where you have a lot of footloose companies starting up. If they can launch their baby business, they're ready to move. I've advised several companies coming to Wales on that basis. If they get the right support and the right skills around as well, by the way, they will come to Wales because they just want to launch their business and make it a success. So that sort of message we've seen last week, if you look at a KPMG report again, you'll see that draws out those sorts of lessons about Wales. So it's awfully predictable. What about Brexit? We'll touch on it very briefly.
Shall we come to that after Brexit?
Excellent.
I think there's the material for a interactive discussion
on Brexit later.
Possibly a punch up. I don't know.
You shut me up very nicely.
Lynn, just lift our spirits.
Go on then. Well, I've got the job of going last, which means that everyone else has already nicked all the good points. So I suppose I would step back and say that I think that my role on this panel is to bring maybe an external perspective, being, as you can tell, not Welsh. But my day job really is kind of spatial economics and what makes places different, what makes them tick, and how you drive success. And I've been doing that for 16 years with Arup, thinking about the economies of places. And over the last 4 years, I've led Arup's involvement with the What Works Centre for Local Economic Growth, which is a collaborative research centre between Arup, the London School of Economics, and the Centre for Cities think tank. And we have been collectively looking at the impact evidence of saying, well, problem diagnosis is one thing, but when we look at what's happened when people try to do some of these policies, that we're always told are the drivers of positive change in local economies. What's the evidence of what the impacts of those are, and what do we know about how and why they vary? So that's sort of been my day job for the last few years. So whilst I'm not a Welsh specialist, that's kind of the perspective I come from. So when we look at this question, I think, you know, the analyst in me wants to break this down into parts, right? So is Welsh economic development struggling to keep up? And I think we've got a fairly categorical yes there. I mean, pretty much when you look across all the sort of standard economic indicators that we look at that indicate economic health of an area, Wales lags, has been pointed out by my my colleagues on the panel here, and has done over some time, and at various points there are various chinks of optimism in some of those figures. But the pattern is lagging, and the pattern in the UK is of increasing regional economic divergence. But it's worth saying that Wales isn't alone in this. I mean, these are basically the great economic challenges of our time, not just in the UK, but globally. So, you know, the sort of the bias of growth towards places that innovate, the ascendancy of cities and the importance of scale and growth, the inability to be protectionist and to sort of look after your own area in a global world, and the sort of spatial inequality that comes out of this. These are the big things that people are grappling with all over the world, and smaller towns and cities are all struggling to cope with this, and Wales is an economy full of small towns and cities. So, you know, there's an element, I suppose, of kind of not tilting at windmills. Like, these are global trends, and so the sort of two responses for me are to kind of, firstly, to grab whatever opportunities are offered by these sort of global forces and changes and harness them to best effect in Wales. And the other is just think about how you pragmatically sort of mitigate against the negative effects of those. So, you know, it's worth saying that these sort of big global economic trends completely outwith our ability to control, but they have really differential spatial impacts, right? So the way in which these big trends differ between places will depend on the size and scale of that place, the sort of sectoral composition of its businesses, the demographics of the place and the trends in time, and a bit of geography stuff. So there's this thing that economists call path dependency, where you can get into both positive and negative reinforcing spirals, which is really tricky to get out of. And, you know, doing the rounds on Twitter this week was a really great piece of investigative reporting in FT, where they went to Blackpool and were looking about the sort of, not only the sort of innate sort of characteristics of Blackpool and how that affected its economic future, but the fact that over time it has been becoming more and more spatially concentrated deprivation because people sort spatially. So when you've essentially, you know, people that have low skills and low wages and don't do well in work tend to move towards places where property is cheap and amenities are few, and the people who do well in those places move out. So over time you get this concentration of deprivation, and all small towns and peripheral economies in the UK have that problem. Blackpool's perhaps one of the worst, but it's a problem that everyone faces. And really, where you don't have a big city to kind of harness that scale and growth, it is difficult to challenge that. So that was gloomy. But it sort of leads you to sort of, what do you do about it then? And the first thing to say is that the diagnosis of the problem is fairly easy. And it's fairly simple to think that you just reverse the thing that you've identified as the problem, and then that's the solution. But it isn't sort of always that simple, I think. There are a lot of things that we do where we think, well, we've identified a problem here, we'll just throw some money at that. And it doesn't necessarily seem to follow that that's the way, you know, that the correlation is not always the causation, and just because you've identified the problem doesn't mean you can fix it. But here's what we need to do about it. Sort of, I'm talking really from a national perspective and from a Welsh Government perspective. The first thing is that the national government has to be stopped being really so spatially blind. They apply national policy with no real understanding of how it affects different places. And I say that not to suggest that you always change what you do, but it's good to be aware of what you do, because sometimes you can tweak your policies so that you don't have those unintended consequences. And I feel quite strongly that we're terribly, terribly bad at really understanding that. The second thing is that just productivity is the absolute key. It's at the nub of all of this. Welsh productivity is something like 8% of the UK average per job, and it's actually slightly lower than that when you look at it per hour worked. And that's just a massive challenge, and everything flows from that. And it's worth saying that the UK overall isn't doing well in productivity. So we're lagging a national average that is pretty shabby anyway. So really, when you're looking at productivity, when we sort of gathered all the evidence we could in the What Works Centre, the things that we found really are driving that are no surprise to you. They're skills, first and foremost, human capital. which means training, which means much bigger focus in all the way across the skills sector. So it's not just higher education, although it is that. It's apprenticeships, it's getting people into work through non-traditional pathways, which does a great deal for equity as well as efficiency. It's focusing on secondary schools, which really are usually the weak point in local education systems. And I, likewise, would be extremely inclined to put a 10% boost on teachers' wages or do any of those relatively cheap measures. I think secondary schools are really overlooked in terms of quality and skills. But it's not just that. It's both retaining the good people you have and attracting the good people that you don't yet have. You'll all have seen the research that Centre for Cities published looking at migration internally and brain drain and what have you. And these are all problems that you try to arrest. And you do that really through quality of place, through having a good amenity offer, through trying to attract firms that are at the higher end of the innovation scale, and then embed them in the local market. The other thing which is sometimes overlooked, I think, is labour market participation. I was at a conference last week where Vivian Hunt, the managing director of McKinsey, presented some really great research that they'd done, where she sort of looked at participation in the UK workforce and said, if as many women were in the workforce as men, and they worked as many hours as men, and the distribution of men and women across the occupational types were equalised, there would be some astonishingly large sort of productivity and GDP boost to the UK. So I think there are some hidden wins there, actually, where if we can start pulling people who are outside the labour market or inefficiently used in the labour market into the labour market, we can have some good wins. I guess I would say that my tendency as an economist is to say that where you have place-based policy, you really want to invest in your big cities and do what you can to grow and densify those cities. So in terms of infrastructure and housing and all of those sort of physical and tangible things, I'm strongly inclined not to spread the jam and to sort of resist pressure to try and spread that to rural areas to appear to be treating everyone equally. I don't think that does anyone any favours in the long run. Skills and education and training, I would jam spreads very, because those people can move when they need to where they're best used. But infrastructure should focus on cities, and I think in South Wales, that's the M4 corridor. And probably in North Wales, it's looking towards Liverpool and Manchester and the Northern Powerhouse. And I thought I would end with some reasons to be cheerful, because it's been a bit gloomy. So the first thing is I do think government is starting to recognise this problem. The Industrial Strategy Commission reported last week and was very firmly saying that, you know, we need to not only take decisions on the basis of national efficiency, but we need to think of equity and equality. There's a sort of no place left behind feeling to it, a concept of a universal basic infrastructure that all places should have. There's a newly formed UK Research Institute, which pulls together the research funding authorities. It will be newly formed next month, maybe. And it has a mandate to better distribute public sector funded research around the UK. At the moment, it's something like 50% in the Golden Triangle of Oxford, Cambridge, London, when about 25% of the institutions are there. And I think, you know, the move, albeit glacially slow, towards devolution and a better sort of location of first money and hopefully subsequently power in local areas will ultimately be a good thing. And I will stop there because I'm a little way from the back.
So you've stopped at him. Thank you very much. Actually, we should clap you. We'll clap you. Before we get into questions, I'm going to take the privilege of asking the first question, because you've stopped at exactly the point I wanted to pick up.
Oh.
Because 20 years ago, when I was working in Wales and working on devolution, you know, much of the analysis that we've talked about this just now was very familiar to us, and certainly one of the ways I thought about what devolution, and I encouraged people in the Welsh office to think about devolution, was it was a great opportunity to tackle some of these problems in a more distinctive way. And you know, this business of spending all the money on the drugs bill so that people could be economically inactive rather than on education, which is clearly the right thing to do, that was a big theme. Infrastructure, well, I mean, that's all part of a UK-wide problem. I mean, I think London's short of infrastructure. It's everywhere, actually. But, you know, there's a lot of familiar themes in what was talked about. So the question I really wanted to ask you all is, and if the government thinks the answer to regional inequality is more devolution to English regions, You know, you have to start with the question, has Welsh devolution been a missed opportunity? 20 years is long enough, I think, to see whether it's fulfilled some of the promise. I mean, you know, it's kept up. Wales has kept up. But I think we hope for more. I think we did hope for more distinctive policies in some of these key areas like skills and education, because there's nothing new here. And that was based on analysis of, you know, other regions and other countries that seemed to us at the time to be doing well, such as Ireland, for example, which spent, and Scotland, both of which spent spectacularly more of their Barnett formula on education and less on health. But Wales was pouring it all into health. We were spending loads of money on doshing up those houses up the valleys and trying to take jobs to them, rather than equipping people to cope with the modern world. So sorry, I've been boiling to say that as you've all been talking. But I would love somebody, you know, people who've been there, to just comment on has devolution been a missed opportunity?
As I said to many ministers, you cannot artificially put businesses in a place and expect it to work. It is much better to actually put the infrastructure in to enable the people to go to Cardiff or to go to another area in a simple way, so that they then bring that money back to their area and then they grow it naturally, rather than this, you know. How many times have we tried to put money into some of these valleys where, and it's wrong, it's still to this there are pockets that work, but it isn't everywhere. And so you're totally right, we just keep doing the same thing.
What do you think? You've been closer to it than me.
I think it's there's one element in this which I think explains quite a lot of the problem. The Welsh government has been very easy to capture by the producer interest. So, you know, in schools, for example, we are going to abolish all measures of relative performance because that's divisive, and we're going to trust the profession. And you know, it took 10 years, but the jury came back and said, your performance has drifted relative to England, where they have not trusted the professional and they've employed these divisive measures. Now, as a good egalitarian Welshman, my feeling is somewhere between the two, that you should trust the professional, but you should give the professional objectives, and you should say, you're the professional, do it the way you like, but I'm going to hold you to these objectives. We've agreed these objectives between us. And you're going to do it your way, but at the end of the day, I'm going to look at these objectives and say, have you delivered? And if you haven't, somebody's for the high jump. And we just didn't do it. We were totally captured by the, very reluctantly, 10 years late, Leighton Andrews starts to reintroduce banding for schools. Point one. The same thing is true in health. Now, I take a brutal attitude in health. Health is 50% of the Welsh budget. And given the demographic trends and the way things are going, if you remain with producer capture, it's going to be 60% and you won't be able to do anything. I think we've got to say, look, we don't need GPs. GPs are obsolete. A computer program, it's been proven, will diagnose 98% of ailments better than a GP, because it's A, it's up to date, and B, it doesn't forget anything. So I will employ nurses in health centers with a computer program and a phone line to a specialist, and I don't need a GP. Hospitals. You try and close a hospital in Wales, it's like the French Revolution. I mean, you know, the sans-culottes are on the streets. I mean, we got to close half of them. It's been scientifically shown that if you do 10,000 operations, you're twice as good as the guy doing five. So we buy a fleet of helicopters, tell people, listen, we'll take you to the hospital. We can do what the Swedes do. You build a hotel next to every hospital. The family wants to come and visit the person in hospital. They're in the hotel at a cheap rate right next door. And by the way, we'll give them a Skype. Give them a bloody iPad in each bed, and you can Skype your family and tell them you're doing all right in hospital. But, you know, meanwhile, we're going to close half the hospital. If we don't get a grip and use technology and what we know to be true to raise productivity in the health service, we're going out backwards. We cannot simply afford to do it any other way. So I think, yeah, absolutely right. We've been captured by the producers. We've not, I'm absolutely, as a good old-fashioned lefty, I'm very glad we haven't gone the full neoliberal route. But if you've got to be tough with the producers as well. If we're dominated by the producer interest, as we have been, you just never get it right. and I think we have to spend much more on education and much less on health.
I don't want to be party political tonight, but I think one of the central issues over the 18 years of devolution, and undoubtedly on balance, certainly from the economic point of view, other points of view somewhat different, it has been disappointing. And one of the issues we have, of course, is that we've effectively had one-party rule. Now, when I say one party, I'm not going to attack the single party, but the very fact we have had one-party rule, because nothing makes politicians think more carefully about what they're doing, what they're planning, than the danger of being kicked out of office and another party coming in. And yet in Wales, that hasn't happened. We've had two coalitions at various times, but fundamentally, we've had one-party rule for 18 years. And to my mind, that's not healthy in any democracy, and it's certainly not healthy in Wales. I also agree with what Jerry said about the producer capture. I mean, the Objective One programme was a classic of that, where the money we got from the European Union was we dolloped a little bit out to each local authority. So rather than saying, right, we're getting this money, I think under the current structural programme, we get about 370, is it, million pounds a year? Mm. Instead of saying, what could we do over, say, a 4 or 5 year programme, £1.5 billion, a few big things, we tend to give each local council, because a lot of them are Labour councils, a bit of money to keep them happy so they can open some, you know, new sports shed or something. And therefore, there's been no strategic thinking about this. And trying to keep everybody happy at the end is, of course, we end up with mediocrity. And it strikes me, because I was on the Silk Commission, when I was visiting the Scottish government of the Scottish Civil Service, they are far more delivery focused, they are far more confident about what they understand to be the project. And they're not all SNP, by the way. Mm. You know, they want to build Scotland, make Scotland more successful. And they're very incisive about that. It has helped, by the way, Rachel and Barnett money, that they get a lot more per capita than Wales. Let's recognise that. We've suffered from that since about, 1978, something like that, the Barnett formula. But nevertheless, they've got much more, you've got the feeling they're looking to the future, taking control for themselves. I was going to say, before I was so rudely interrupted, I was very dangerous.
Graciously
interrupted, I stand corrected. I was in a dangerous thing for the city to quote Lenin. But you know, Lenin said, you divide mankind into the who and the whom. My question is, we've got to switch from being the whom to the who. We need, you know, Wales needs to, because a lot of the key policy areas, education, skills, they are devolved.
Yes.
So, you know, we shouldn't be blaming London there now. We can do things ourselves. And where we've made moves very often, as Jerry pointed out in education, we got rid of standards, we got rid of measurement.
Yeah.
And that was, in my view, a disaster. You know, we just shouldn't have done that sort of thing. So we've got to be much more hard-nosed and clear-minded. Because the Welsh government's had a poor record of delivery. What's even more, by the way, then they've sucked more. I mean, interesting to hear Margaret's view, like the WDA, they closed it.
Great mistake.
It disappeared into the civil service. You try and find out what the equivalent's done now. I mean, my view, if you didn't like what the WDA was doing, its direction, you fire the chairman, the board, and no disrespect, and the chief exec, and you put some others and give them a new remit. But what you don't do is just make it disappear into the civil service, where it's incredibly opaque now what it's doing. So, you know, accountability is a key thing. But to my mind, one of the biggest issues if we could tackle it is, you know, have the threat of a change of government. Any change.
So I'm going to let you off commenting on whether Welsh devolution has been a missed opportunity, because I want to open it up to the floor now. I mean, if anybody wants to quarrel with that rather gloomy analysis, should we come back in a sec? That rather gloomy analysis, and speak up for the Welsh Assembly and its seizing the opportunities, that would be great. But do you want to say who you are?
So I'm Thomas Edwards. I work for Bank of America Merrill Lynch here in London.
Right.
And I'm an ex-employee of the Welsh Development Agency.
I think you're going to agree, aren't you?
13 years ago, I left to forge a career in London. It pains me to say that, yes, we've had a one-party state since 1999. It pains me to say further that the civil servants I've worked with at WDA are still working in the civil service, although they've moved on to different projects. I'm very proud of the fact that I've left Wales, I've come out, I've worked with a global perspective for a global investment bank. Yes, we haven't been completely innocent for everything, the world's ills over the last sort of 7 or 8 years. But I just want to pick up on the mediocrity. If you've got the same civil servants as moving from one project to the other without any private sector experience whatsoever, you've got the same government ministers and AMs, Leighton Andrews is a name that was knocking around when I was there 10, 15 years ago. It's the same AMs, the same civil service. Unless they're going out to get experience outside of Wales, then how can they bring back and bring best practice back into Wales itself?
So is the evolution a good idea?
I have to say, I fully agree with you. I think part of the problem is, and we expect kids to know what they want to do and be ambitious, but they don't know what good looks like because nobody ever is. You know, there used to be a time when a lot of people were educated outside of Wales and then they came back in. I mean, I came back eventually. Many of us in this room came back. But you've got to see what there is out there to know what is good, to know how to drive a business. Actually, part of the problem, let's be honest about productivity, is quality of management. Because most of the targets that people have, I mean, they're meaningless, as you say. I mean, our targets in Welsh Government are to create jobs of whatever type they are, whether they're suitable or not. So it's very sad, and I fully agree with you.
Did you want to?
I just wanted to come back and say that whilst there are lots of reasons to not like a long incumbent government, one of the things that the sort of 4-year political cycle is particularly bad for is strategic and brave decisions on investment in infrastructure. So it seems to me like an especially missed opportunity to have had this long period of single government that might have had the opportunity to take some bold and long-sighted decisions and seems not to have done that.
And especially since the analysis was there 20 years ago. I mean, I think we knew that you had to spend more on education, for example. I think it's very sad.
I think one of the things you've got to give the Welsh Government credit for is awareness of their own limitations. You know, they were thinking about building an M4 relief road in 2006 and decided it was probably a bit too expensive. You know, it was a big chunk of the budget, just too big. And they've been cautious, extremely cautious, but I think that reflects the fact that there is a lack of managerial capability within the civil service. There are some excellent people in the Welsh Civil Service. There really are. I mean, I'm not just saying that. I know some people who, ex-UK Treasury or other things like that, and very, very competent. But there just aren't enough of them to manage large, complex projects. And I don't blame them for being cautious. But the problem is, when they need to do something big, they are intensely reluctant to bring in the skills they need and to devolve power. And the whole point about getting rid of the IWA is they haven't got their hands on it on a continuous basis. So they've got this conflicting desire to control everything, and then the realization that actually they can't do everything.
Yeah.
Put those two things together, what do you think is going to happen?
So,
nothing.
No, I agree. I mean, that would be one of the worries, whether the political structure has made things worse. I mean, you've got a lot more sort of public scrutiny, I imagine, of what people are doing, which I should think makes them rather risk averse.
But
and, you know, that all these committees and ministers and all the rest of it floating around. Yes, Geraint.
Can I just pick up on that? Because, obviously, you know, I'm on the board of Cardiff Airport. Airport was a brave thing for us to do. But let me tell you, you know, we were down below 900,000 people. You can't have a capital city without an airport. This year, we will make a profit, which is quite extraordinary in the short period of time we've owned that airport. But they were brave enough at that stage to allow people from the private sector who knew how to run the businesses to be able to get that business right. Would we have done it quicker if it was ours? Probably. But actually, we've done it in a very strong, measured way. And so, you know, when they are brave enough, they can do it. So maybe they should learn from that.
I would argue that they need to be even braver, because I would argue, actually, they are probably the least scrutinised government in Britain.
Okay.
Right? They are not under any kind of pressure from the media at all. There are virtually no daily papers that are actually scrutinising their activity. The Western Mail, that I had the pleasure of being assistant editor of about 40 years ago, when the circulation was 98,000, its circulation is now 15,000. There is a real limit to the kind of scrutiny that something like the BBC does. One of the things that newspapers were able to do is to run campaigns. If you look at, say, the West of Mail now, he doesn't run any campaigns. Each day is different. Nothing is carried forward. Public service broadcasters like BBC and ITV do not run campaigns. The Welsh government have got nothing to be afraid of in terms of the media. So I think they can justify, or ought to be able to justify themselves, being much, much braver than they are.
Yes, over there.
Hello, I'm Sean Reed, and my background is running telecoms businesses, and I was leader of Cambridge City Council, too, for a time, with its various centre cities, no, very well with its very high growth programme. I just wanted to, I'm quite interested to pursue your points about political leadership and political vision, but just also in the context of the debate so far has talked about, education or health spending. And in fact, we know that levels of education have a very profound impact on population health. And this isn't a sort of either or. If we can invest in education, it means that the health of the Welsh population would go up with its economic well-being as well. And I think it's very, but it does take a long-term sort of visionary government to see that you need to make those kind of investments in the population in order to improve its health and perhaps then be able to spend less than 50% of its budget even more easily.
Yes.
Helen John, a question for the panel really. You've talked a lot about education, but one of the things we've touched on is essentially an awful lot of our educated people are actually getting up and leaving.
Mm-hmm.
So what can we do to make that investment in education truly an investment, but also what more can we do to bring people home again?
Yes, have a crack at that. Yes.
When I was at the OECD as a young economist, the Lynch government in Ireland decided to have a Keynesian expansion program. And we looked at this and said, Keynesian expansion in an economy that small and that open, they're out of their minds. And they were out of their minds. It did lead to a big balance of payments crisis. But they spent the money on education. And the result was, by the 90s, 20 years later, 45% of the Irish population of the relevant generations had tier 3 educational levels, whereas in England it was 15%. Do you know what? A lot of them emigrated. A lot of them left. But that was a precondition for the whole Celtic Tiger story. When the Americans were looking for an English language place to invest, apart from the sort of green sentiment, Ireland had this very well-trained labour force. And of course, once the Celtic Tiger starts to boom, a lot of those kids did come back.
Mm.
So I just think, there's no complete solution. You've got to throw your bread on the water, and as the good book says, it'll come back after many days. It's a necessary but not sufficient condition.
Yes, at the back.
Sarah Evans, I'm a former member of the Welsh Assembly, so I have some experience of being in there and knowing what it's like. I don't agree entirely that it's been a missed opportunity. I think devolution has worked very well in lots of ways, and I think having policies made in Wales, being closer to Welsh communities, being much more responsive to the needs of those communities has broadly been very good. I think the one elephant in the room is education. And I think, I was a massive supporter of devolution. I worked for John Smith in Westminster when we were driving that policy through, when Labour was in opposition there. Had somebody said to me then, if you go through with devolution, you're going to fall behind significantly on education compared to the rest of the UK, I would have thought twice about it. So I completely agree that is a massive problem that needs to be addressed. But in other areas, I think there are some very positive stories to tell. And one very positive story, I think, at the moment, and I'd be interested to know what the panel have to say about this, is what's going on in a lot of the FE colleges. Because I've been doing some work in HU and FE recently in Wales. Some of the universities are struggling, although Cardiff, I know, is doing very well, actually. You're here to testify to that. But I think some of the FE colleges are doing some really interesting work. They're working very closely with industry. They're trying very hard to step up to the needs of the new economy. And I've been very impressed with that. So I think there are some good things to talk about. And I think future generations are probably going to be the success story of devolution and possibly not what's happened in the first 20 years.
Does anyone want to pick up on that?
But just to say, I agree with you. I think the FE, in terms of those that are not necessarily degree standard, but are more vocational training, I think, particularly now we're looking at apprenticeships, and you are starting to see that come through. And personally, in the work that I've been doing, in fact, I signed an agreement with Royal Caribbean last week where refrigeration engineers, electrical engineers, air conditioning engineers, once they've qualified, that they can go and work on the ships for as long as they like, and then they can come back to Wales afterwards. So it gives them a bit of an international flavour. So, yeah, I think we can help children grow and experience things and then come back to Wales, which is what I would like to see them do.
Yeah, I just wanted to sort of violently agree with you on that front. I think further education has been sort of shamefully neglected and played down over a couple of decades, in fact. And actually, when you sort of drill down into the productivity and the labour shortage issues, it tends not to be at the very top and the bottom that we really struggle. It's in the middle. It's in construction and sort of skilled technical workers. And there's an important equality aspect to that as well, because it helps people get into better education than they might otherwise be able to. And, you know, ARAP as an employer is also sort of thinking about how we can better make use of apprentices coming through our workforce, and we've really sort of shifted our focus on that. A couple of the other points that I wanted to come back on as well, actually, was I wouldn't be that worried about people leaving Wales when they do well. I would be worried if they didn't come back at some point. So I think it's actually good for an economy, for people to move around, for people to go to London to get those skills, bring them back. It's a model that works really well for the home counties of South East England, to send people to London and then to reclaim them at some point. And I think that's a good thing. Slightly devil's advocate-y, it's really tricky for people. There is a tendency to say, oh, well, there's no point training these people up if when they get trained and do well, they leave. Because I sort of think, in some senses, we know much better how to help people and how to help businesses than we do how to help places. And if we can improve people's lives, we should, irrespective of whether they then move on. It's rather parochial to sort of say that's a waste.
Yep.
Can I just add to that? I mean, my last full-time job was running a consultancy here in the city. One of the ways we differentiated ourselves, by the way, was by having a lot of training. We every person I was recruiting, I told them they had an allocated budget for training every year. In fact, in their personal appraisal, if they didn't do the improved training, they'd be marked down. And because a lot of other employers say, well, if you train these people up, you're going to lose them. But it was our job to retain them and be attracted to them. But one of the key attractions was that we provided training. There was quite a few companies in the city weren't doing that. So this idea, of course you're going to lose people, you're going to leak people, but also people will come back. And another thing, I'm not sure about this, it's a little bit contradictory to saying we want them to go out and come back. Came up with a scheme saying, well, you know, with the university students, if they graduate, if they worked in Wales then for 5 years, we'd write off any debts they've incurred in a structured way. Because again, very often, graduates, by the time they get to about 25, they're starting to settle down, and they think this place isn't too bad after all, it's a good place to bring up families and so on, so I'll stay here. And therefore we say, well, why not? Therefore, say if you're here for 5 years after graduating, you have to work out the detail of it, then we'll write off any debts you've got.
It seems appropriate to comment as well that, you know, one of the strengths of both the Irish and the Scottish economies is their diasporas. You know, they've got these fantastic networks outside of smart people who've gone out that continue to be supporters and provide all sorts of support for the economy. I'm particularly struck by the Scottish one, but the Irish too, as you mentioned. Yeah, and the Welsh diaspora is much less developed, I think, probably, although this is a tribute to the fact that it actually exists. Now, look, I think we ought to take a few questions from the audience, because we've all had a bit of a say. So starting with you here.
Keir Lloyd, I work at the Institute for Public Policy Research, which is just a couple of tube stops along. My family, in a sense, has been educated by Wales, but as you can tell by my accent, I've lived and worked in England pretty well all my life. I think there is something about education that's important and how Wales can be distinctive in it, and it feels to me like secondary and FE is perhaps actually where we make a particular investment over and above that would attract and actually bring families back into Wales as part of that sort of flow. And the work that the FT have done on Blackpool sort of reiterates for me that the Welsh Government needs to understand much more thoroughly the flows of its people in and out at different ages and different places.
The thing that changes flow, though, and this is reflective of work that we're doing for the north of England, looking at energy and low carbon goods and services and the transition of the energy intensive industries, is where does demand come from? So my very particular question is, what do you think the Welsh Government, in all its forms and institutions, national and local, could do to focus their demands of Welsh businesses and Welsh economic activity in and for Wales in ways that they may not do at the moment?
Okay, so we hold that question and just take a couple more from around the room, and then before we come back to the panel. I'm hoping someone's going to raise the question, Brexit.
Not me, I'm afraid. So my name's Sarah Welsh Evans, and as a person who's been living in London for the last 4 years, but left Wales at 18 and lived in Australia in between, my friends and I in our 30s in London, from Wales, have been talking a lot about how we address this issue of Margaret described of what good looks like. And we've all reflected on fairly recent careers advice in school, where we were told either that we shouldn't go to uni or we should do something simple. So we've tried to form a network. There's a few of us who are trying to connect professionals from Wales who are living in London elsewhere with students of school age now in Wales, and we'd really, really be keen to talk to anybody who wants to help us or be involved in that, because it's something we think that we can try and help. We're not that old, so maybe 14-year-olds might listen. So, you know, realistically, it's a question for both the panel and for everybody in the room. You know, please help us, and if there's anybody who's willing to do so, come find me. Thank you.
Over there, please. One there and one there.
Mm-hmm. I'm Stephen Aldridge. I'm an Englishman, and I go to Wales a lot, and I'm a trustee at the London Welsh Centre, amongst other things. And on my visit to Wales, I am appalled at the state of the internet access,
yes,
and broadband.
Second
that's
up.
Something that hasn't specifically been brought up, but I see that, you know, that is definitely holding things back, and potentially is could boost productivity. You mentioned things like Skyping the neighbours. Well, you wouldn't be able to Skype neighbours because you can get a
good
broadband
luck with
connection.
That, yes.
And so. You know, I'd be interested to hear thoughts on whether that is a significant element.
Do you realise there are parts of Pembrokeshire that have the fastest broadband in Europe?
It's very patchy.
Oh,
yes, there's one there. Another one there.
Okay. Can I just mention Brexit, I suppose?
Yeah.
I'm Rob Hunter. I'm from the Development Bank of Wales, newly formed, launched in October. But when I came to Wales, and I worked for the Welsh European Funding Office. And when I arrived, I looked at all the projects that were going to be delivered. I was reasonably senior. I was looking after the actual delivery and the finance. And things like Next Generation Broadband Wales, Stations Improvements Programme, Training Young People, Economic Development. The thing that struck me is the government surely should have been doing all of these things anyway. I mean, the stuff we were putting the money into seem to just be displacing what should be core government expenditure in any case. The other thing that struck me was £2 billion going into the economy over 7 years, and it was going to totally transform Wales. If you read the Western Mail, you know, you looked at the political statements. I came from defence. The last project I did in defence was the Type 45 destroyers, and £2 billion would buy you about 1¾ of a Type 45 destroyer. So the idea that actually a couple of £1 billion over 7 years is going to totally transform your economy is laughable, really. On the positive side, we're about to lose that £2 billion. That's not good, but I don't think it was transformative anyway. But what does the panel think should happen next? We're going to lose a lot of money. A lot of that education stuff you're talking about is funded through EU funds. Those additional programmes that really do make that sort of difference at the top end. What do we do now?
Anybody else? Yes, there. I think we'll come back to the panel in a minute.
I just want to take up something that Professor Haltham's point. Yes, spend the money on education, but how do you avoid the producers then, when the money is going into education, diverting it into their pet projects, not something where you can have a clear payback? The sciences, mathematics, computers. It'll end up somewhere where because of the producers. The other point I'd make is I lived overseas for the last 36 years in Hong Kong. The Welsh community was very successful, and you saw the benefits of free enterprise. It seemed to me that given what had happened over Welsh education, I would have thought that the Welsh population would have been up in arms, but they were asleep. They don't seem to have reacted to the decline of Welsh education. What went wrong? Did Leighton Andrews cast a spell over them to make them all fall asleep? The last point I'd make is that should we have some more choices in education in Welsh rather than a one-size-fits-all, so we can see what wins and what does not? Anyway, thank you.
Okay, so there's one more, there's two more people, and then I think I'll come back to the panel. There are three more people. Okay. Just keeping it nice and short.
My name is Mark Young, and I work for Great Western Railway, but this is a personal view, and as you may detect an accent, I'm a Londoner too, but I actually moved 20 years ago down to Wales, studied history and politics at a really nice university that is actually sort of world class in terms of what it offers, being alongside the Gower and the Mongols. And one of my frustrations over the last 20 years, having supported devolution, is Wales seems to me to sort of always blame lots of England. You know, and it was mentioned even on the panel about blaming Crossrail 2, you know, ISPT, when actually those regions and Crossrail 2 actually got off their backsides, you know, fought for the money, have found ways to bring extra money in to improve those infrastructure projects. And my two children sort of growing up will probably benefit from their free bus passes in the future, their free prescriptions in the future, but their education and their job opportunities will always be sort of held back. And I think what was a particularly pertinent point was the fact that, you know, like 55% of, you know, people who leave school don't go into sort of education. And until we maybe tackle an issue that is another elephant in the room, that the Welsh Government, by virtue of the fact that it's been a one-party state, likes to offer things for free, you know, but doesn't like to generate income, you know, and take more difficult, you know, decisions, we will always be in this never, you know, ever decreasing circle. And it's a frustration, I think, for many that we do like in Wales to actually blame England a lot, you know. And, you know, when points like Margaret mentioned about Airbus, you know, and the fact that you've got places like the Gower, Snowdonia, you know, my mother came to sort of Cardiff for the first time in 10 years and was taken aback by what Cardiff offers shopping-wise. But if there's no hotels there for people to stay and enjoy it for a weekend, you know, what are we doing? And yet, you know, we can offer free bus passes, free prescriptions, we can offer now free tolls on the Severn Bridge. But if you've got nowhere for somebody to stay, or you've got poor education, they're just going to be driving out, or they're going to be going to other places. That was a bit of a rant.
Can I just say, I mean, we have 4,700 beds of the standard that they require for the European Cup Winners' Cup in Cardiff, for a stadium that had took 75,000 that night. So that doesn't have to tell you what a stupid idea it was. Yeah, it was great. It put Wales on the map. But where did the money go? It didn't stay in Wales. It went out of Wales because everybody commuted back to London or to places outside of Wales. So there is no point in doing these things unless we do it properly.
I mean, the danger is we're all going to go to a vortex of pessimism. I happen to work in Cardiff from 74 to 1979. And then I left. And then I returned to Cardiff. I bought a house there about 22 years ago because I always planned when I stopped working full time that I would go back to Wales and I want to go to Cardiff. And the transformation of Cardiff in terms of hotels, restaurants and everything since the 70s to now is tremendous, by the way. Now, Cardiff still has a lot to do, but I mean, I can remember the only hotel used to be the Angel Hotel. I'm looking at it, maybe there were one or two others barely there.
Park Hotel.
The Park, maybe. But I mean, now things like hotels, restaurants, cultural facilities are far superior. And of course, things get a little bit out of balance, but you're not going to build half a rugby stadium first of all, and then 5 years later expand it again, so you're going to get lack of balance. But I defend that completely, that we've done that. And I think, you know, that it does help raise the profile of Wales, and the hotel capacity has increased considerably. We still need more, but there's a lot there as well.
Let me tell you, the reason that we don't have more is because the imbalance of usage of hotels in Wales, believe it or not, we actually have full hotels at weekends, but we don't have them during the week. And what does that tell us? That tells us that it's our business users that are poor. They're not the ones that are coming to Wales during the week. They just might come for the day. But so we can't change it because we've got the wrong balance.
Well, you build a conference centre or improve the conference facilities, don't you?
Well, Terry Matthews is building one of those at Newport, all right? And it's all credit to Terry Matthews.
He's got the huge resort hotel there and he's doing it.
Not got the capacity to do it, he's doing it as well. So let's get completely clear.
Indeed. I think, yes, there were two people there who wanted to say something, and then I think we need to have a structured return to the panel to reflect on what we think we've learned.
Helen Morin, Chair of the IWA. I was struck by Lynn's comment about not spreading the jam too thinly. And the evidence on that, I think, is pretty incontrovertible, but how do you square that with the politics of, for example, the Cardiff City Region deal being managed by 10 local authorities who all have to deliver something for their region and getting them to understand the potential impact that could be made if they pooled the money and spent it wisely? I'd be interested in the comments, the panel's thoughts on how we change the mindset.
Okay, so time for just one more question.
Hi, good evening. I'm Anthony Pickles. I used to work for the Welsh Conservatives once upon a time, and we'll leave that there. About 8 or 9 years ago, I remember the conversation was always about how does Wales compete with the Republic of Ireland? How does it compete with the preferential tax rates of Northern Ireland and Scotland? And then the Silk Commission happened, the Wales Bill, and now Wales Act was granted, and tax powers now are beginning to reside in Cardiff Bay. And in May of this year, right along the Welsh border, you've got 4 combined authorities in England that potentially are going to leapfrog them. They're going to have powers which is far more powerful. So why the reticence in Wales? Why all of the clamour for these powers and then the reticence to use them?
Okay, so I think we've got a number of issues that people can pick up if they want to, or things that they want to say that they haven't had an opportunity to say.
We'll
go around. Start with you.
Well, if I could take Anthony's point, because he knows I was on the Silk Commission.
Yes.
And in fact, we did recommend the partial devolution of income tax, for instance. To my mind, that didn't go far enough, because, and I won't go into the technical details now, but if you're only going to devolve half the income tax, 10p on the standard rate and so on, it raises some really difficult issues. So I wanted to see much more tax being devolved, frankly, to put the feet of the Welsh Government, and not just the Welsh Government, the National Assembly, to the fire. And therefore, you know, they'd feel much more that whatever policies we're pursuing, one of the key questions is how is this going to impact our revenue? You know, because if we do these things, does this going to buoy the economy? Because there's quite a close correlation between GVA per capita and tax per capita. You'd expect that if you look at the definition of GVA. So then they'd have to think much harder. If we're doing this particular policy, spending money in a particular way, are we going to get a return on that investment? And frankly, the partial devolution of income tax isn't severe enough for that. Because if I just touch on Brexit at the same time, therefore, I think I'm very pessimistic. I've always been very strong pro-European, just so you understand. Even in 1975, I campaigned then for a sustainable then common market. But is the trouble is it may not be shocking enough when we Brexit. It may be a slow erosion of position over 5 or 10 years, not a dramatic one. Because in a way, you could argue, you know, a crisis is always an opportunity. And because one example that after 2008, the financial crisis, the then coalition government, Labour Plaid Cymru, came up with this PROACT and REACT programmes, quite modest programmes, but nevertheless to help support employment in the aftermath of that crisis. They worked and it was fairly effective. And can we now get to a position, if Brexit is going to have a severe impact, that will that'll galvanise Wales and galvanise not just the government, the National Assembly as well, and others. And the last point, since Cardiff City Council, that the group that was raised, I was for a period a non-exec on two publicly quoted companies based in Manchester for some reason. But, I mean, we've got a lot to learn from Manchester. Manchester Airport Group owns, I think, Stansted now as well. Yeah. Because, so when people are criticising the Welsh government for buying the airport, I say, well, lots of airports around the world are municipally owned or government owned. That's not the issue, you know. And it's, I'm delighted to see it's doing so well. But, you know, we could learn a lot from Manchester, where there's a set of councils that have collaborated that over many years. Yes. And that, to a degree, they've subsumed their immediate parochial interest in the interest of the greater Manchester area.
And why has that been possible? Because of one-party rule.
One party and strong leadership.
And strong leadership.
Strong leadership.
You know, I think that's been and a couple of really impressive people.
Yeah, absolutely.
So
yeah.
One-party rule isn't always fatal, well, as you said. That's a good example, I think.
I'm going to make a public...
You're going to be next.
I'm going to make a public confession about tax. I chaired a thing which came to be known as the Holtham Commission, which first looked at the Barnett formula and at taxation and recommended tax devolution. And in fact, those were the suggestions largely followed by the Silk Commission. I'm feeling very guilty because the problem about tax devolution is that you replace what was a grant by your own revenue. And we're going to have about 2.5 billion out of 16 billion. Will no longer be a grant, but will come from domestic taxes. Now, Erville is quite right that if the government can affect GDP, it now has a stronger incentive to do the right thing. But the government's got a very limited ability to stop Tata closing Port Talbot. It's not going to be able to prevent the rundown of the Ford engine plant. And if Brexit finally results in those wings being made somewhere else, the Welsh economy is going to go for a loop, and there's very little that the government can do about it. And I think, oh my God, I got the poor buggers to have their own taxes, just as the silly sods then went and voted for Brexit, and now we're all, the combination of their idiocy and my mistake, we're all in the soup. And so shoot me afterwards. But I mean, I think, and that is the point. You know, if you had more income tax, you'd have even more risk. I mean, the point about the devolution, it was a fine judgment because yes, you wanted more responsibility. It was idiotic that the government didn't raise any of its own finance. That's not a government. That's a I can't think of the right word, but it's Mickey Mouse. So they had to have some tax. But the more you give them, the more open they are to these kind of risks they can't control. So there was a trade-off there, and I don't know that we should have that we'd be happy now if all income tax to Wales had been devolved and we were collecting 6 billion of our own money and that was all at risk. So I think that's where we are. But it's certainly I think I share with Irville the fear that this won't be a shock. It'll be a slow attenuation. They're not going to get rid of the Ford engine plant in 18 months, but you know whether it's going to be there in 5 years' time or 10 years' time is another question. So there is a risk here that what we've done is to induce a situation where growth is just very much slower for quite a protected period of time, and that will have an adverse effect on Welsh Government revenue. The question was asked, what should we do about the fact that we're not going to get the money from Europe anymore? Well, when you talk to people and said, hey, did you know we were net recipients of money from Europe? Why did you vote to leave? Oh, well, we know the UK as a whole is paying more than it gets back. So when the British government doesn't have to pay that, it'll have enough money to see us right. So there's this sort of faith in Wales that by being loyal Britons, you know, we'll get our reward from Westminster. And my reaction to that is rather like yours. You know, I've got bad news for you about Father Christmas. I think there is a risk. But I mean, I will say, although I'm strongly in the camp that says we've got to stand on our own feet, we can't keep moaning about England. I resonate with what the gentleman over there was saying. There is too much blame deflection. On the other hand, there's no harm in a bit of chutzpah, you know. I mean, we're not aggressive enough. I mean, the Scots go out there and they, you know, if you've given them a marginal disadvantage, They're all over the wall. They're up on the ceiling. They're screaming and shouting. You know, whereas if you screw us, I mean, we just look a bit sad about it. I mean, I think we're supposed to actually, really say, look, because if we hadn't voted for Brexit, we'd be in a stronger position because we could blame them for doing that to us. But we can't blame them because we did it to ourselves. But the point is, I think we do have to lobby really hard that the base of the Barnett formula has to have a one-time shift now to reflect the fact that there's a block of money that we used to get and we're not getting it anymore. So you will please stick that in the base, and after that, Barnett will look after the growth, but we're going to have a one-time up mark for this, and if we don't, we play the bear in every conceivable way. I mean, if we were French, we'd drive tractors up Whitehall. I mean, I don't know, we just have to be really aggressive, I think, about that. That may not be the most constructive thing you've ever heard, but I really don't see any other way. I mean, you just got to be thoroughly bloody. What to say? Broadband, I think that I entirely agree. There are a couple of areas where I think the Welsh Government, again, it's this lack of managerial capacity, has in a sense abdicated to the private sector. It's doing it over the metro, you know, because it hasn't set up an adequate authority to do it. It said to companies, we want a metro, tell us what that is and how much it'll cost. So, you know, you've abdicated public policy to the people who are putting in the tenders. You're supposed to say, this is what we want, we've worked it out, how much does it cost? They haven't done that. They're saying, we want something called a metro, tell us what it is and how much you're going to charge us for it. And then they pick the one they like best. So you've actually completely abdicated responsibility for policy formation, and we've done that over broadband. We got this deal with BT. BT, please give us lots of nice broadband, and everybody I talk to tells me it's a disaster. I don't know, I don't think we haven't applied the managerial resources to do policy in house and keep private sector suppliers under control. And I think broadband is a classic case of that. There were 10 questions. I've covered 3, but I'll shut up.
Okay, no, it's just you can be selective. So, Margaret, do you want to pick up on anything that's said
or
any final words?
I know that people probably thought I was being critical, but actually there are a lot of good things in Wales, and I think sometimes, for instance, with the broadband, you know, there are extraordinary changes that have gone on in very rural areas where the broadband is really quite good, and in fact I'm in discussions for Network Rail to develop a very high level 5G system that will link in with the NASA space station and all the research that they do up in the drones in North Wales. So there are things we can do, and I think part of it is that all of us that can do should do, and I think that's how the message should be tonight. That it isn't, I'm not being negative, what I'm saying is we can do a lot of things much better, and those things we know that are wrong, we should try and influence to get them right.
Just one quick thought. On this issue of, you know, the 10 local authorities and the city region and why it's going in that way, I think this is an area where the Welsh Government could have been, with advantage, a little bit more authoritarian. Because this city deal doesn't exist unless they put money in. I mean, that's the Treasury's deal. We'll put some money in, local authorities put some money in, Welsh Government puts some money in. Welsh Government's gone over a barrel. It says, nah, we're not putting a cent in. There's no city deal. So if it says, listen, 10 local authority heads on a committee, give me a break, no chance. We're setting up, you know, a city deal authority with a chief executive, and if you don't want that, there's no city deal. What choice would they have? You know,
too much competition.
Can we
for the
say
assembly?
That? Actually, we will share with you with the Development Bank, because to be fair to some of these councils, many of you might not be aware that they can borrow money off the UK government. There's limits, but they can borrow it at 1.5%. They see that there are many sites that need developers to come in, inward investment, which is what we've talked about. So they have come to the Development Bank to see if they borrow the money at 1.5%, can we then give them an infrastructure fund which they can then use to give to the developers to open up the land. You know, it's a simple thing,
okay.
But it will kickstart some of the development. So they are trying.
Okay, well, they need to try even harder after Brexit, because I don't think inward investment into Wales is going to look quite the deal it did 20 years ago. So, Lynn.
Right, so I think everyone probably wants to have a drink of wine. So
they do. So you have the final word.
Yeah, this is good. Isn't
what
it?
Are we missing?
As my party trick, I'm going to try and go backwards and give you one line in response to every single one of them. So the risk reticence to use fiscal powers answer, I think, is simply that it's incredibly risky for lagging regions to push for full fiscal devolution, because you end up in a Detroit situation at the extreme. Jam spreading, the answer is those 10 local authorities should only be in the Cardiff City region deal because they are functionally part of one region. And so they should be making decisions that are best for the city region, not for their little patch of it. Otherwise, the thing is a nonsense. Yes, I really, really strongly agree with you that we have to be much smarter at levering in private sector investment and thinking about land value capture and how we fund things when we're delivering infrastructure. How to get the most out of education spending is to listen much more carefully to what employers want. And to link much better to skills, which broadly speaking means STEAM, which is STEM but with arts and creative in there as well, kind of analytical stuff. Brexit, I can see two silver linings of Brexit. One is cap reform, which is a horrible, protectionist, terrible policy. Second is the chance to set a better migration policy, both of which could have some long-term good impacts. I don't think either of them outweigh the potential negative impact, so the answer of what we should do is do everything we can to stop it happening. Broadband, yes, good, but the economic benefits of broadband are likely to be concentrated in cities rather than rural areas, is what the evidence tends to suggest. That doesn't mean you shouldn't do it in rural areas as a public good rollout, but you should be sort of cautious about what that's going to do if that's your way of driving growth. Mentoring, I went to university with a Welsh man, he's in London, I'm going to give him your name. And local government purchasing, I feel really strongly, is a really bad policy, because if those local services were the best services, the council should already be procuring them. And if they're not, then it's a bad deal for the taxpayer. And if everyone starts doing it, then again, lagging regions have far more to lose than to gain. If Wales starts purchasing only from Welsh businesses, then fine, but if Cardiff and London start doing the same, then, you know, we're pretty much all screwed in the lagging regions. So I think it's really bad economic policy. And that's it.
Great, thanks very much. Well, I think it just sort of remains for me to thank the panel. I think we've agreed on an awful lot, and not least where Wales has come from and the scale of the challenge that a sort of post-extractive industry area of the country faces. And the legacy is from the people as well, actually. As you were saying, the thing that struck me most about Wales when I was there was exactly this functional illiteracy at the bottom of the labour market, and it's a real problem, and that's one of the things that lies behind the economic inactivity, which is part of the trouble. So, but I think the point that Gerry was making about, you know, despite all that, Wales has kept pace. You know, there's a levels problem, but, it hasn't... Let's not think ourselves into a great gloom. Wales has kept pace with the rest of the country through a very tough period, which the last 10 years have been. And, things are not slipping back. But we obviously can learn from places like the North East and that have done better. And I think the answers will turn out to be about education. I think everybody in the room has a different version of that as being the most important thing. I mean, it's very sad that devolution hasn't the opportunities of devolution haven't been seized more decisively, but it's still only 20 years old and there's plenty of time to get it right. No, seriously, that's not long in the great sweep of things. We haven't spent a lot of time talking about Brexit, but if it is the negative headwind that it could easily be for Wales in many ways we haven't discussed, I mean, maybe that will inspire somebody to show a bit of leadership and think more strategically about how to realise the opportunities that devolution actually does offer. So I think we have earned a drink. Thank you all very much for contributing to the debate, as well as the panel.
Ladies and gentlemen, just before we finish, very, very briefly, because I do need to tell you that We need to vacate the place at 9:15 because people who work here need to get out. I'm going to just display brief vote of thanks in a moment. Before I do that, there's one panelist who sacrificed her evening on quite a special date. It's her birthday, so we please. So just a big thanks to all of you for coming and spending your time this evening at IWA, well done, and to all our panelists. Thank you very much.